Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, January 13th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Aaron. Today on the show, we are discussing a pair of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court today. Both of these cases have to do with whether or not a state can bar transgender girls and women from competing in girls and women's sports. This has been a lightning rod issue all across the country for several years now. It has culminated, at least legally, in these two cases. So we're going to tell you about the cases, and we're going to hear about the potential ramifications from a pair of experts, Kate Shaw and Michael Moreland. Stay tuned for that conversation in about 10 minutes, and we want to hear from you. Should transgender athletes be allowed to compete in women's and girls' sports? Call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat.
Yeah, specifically if you're a trans athlete or the parent of a trans person, or you're just or you just have strong opinions on this, give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And of course, we have our trio of news stories. And so we're going to jump right in. Top story, Dina Powell McCormick, the wife of Senator Dave McCormick, who represents Pennsylvania, she will be the new president and vice chair of Meta. You know that company, the one
certainly do,
that
yes.
owns Facebook. Yes. Well, if you've never heard of Powell McCormick, apparently she's a real power player. She's been on Meta's board of directors since last April, where she focused on the pursuit of highly advanced artificial intelligence. But before Meta, she spent 16 years at Goldman Sachs. And in 2023, she became president and vice chair of BDT and MSD Partners. That's an investment banking firm. She's also very influential in conservative politics. She served as senior advisor and assistant secretary of state to President George Bush. She also served in President Donald Trump's first administration. And Trump was so happy. The president was so happy about the appointment. He posted, "Great choice by Mark Z on Truth Social."
Mark Zuckerberg, yes.
Meaning Mark Zuckerberg, yeah. And of course, you know, Mark Zuckerberg has been growing his relationship with President Donald Trump over the past couple of years and has been bringing a number of very influential Republicans into his C-suite and into the fold at Meta.
Yeah. And there's a Pennsylvania angle to all of this. One thing that Dave McCormick, who's a freshman senator, by the way, you know, is got a pretty small footprint in Washington at this point. But one thing he's been trying to focus a lot of energy on is AI. And bringing AI-related jobs and data center-related jobs and building to the state of Pennsylvania. He had a big summit about this last year. And so now he'll have a personal connection to a company that is investing billions of dollars in building out data centers and trying to, you know, win the AI race, whatever exactly that means. And so you can't ignore that angle of it as well. This could, on some level, lead to Pennsylvania having a higher profile on Capitol Hill at 1600 Pennsylvania and in the tech industry.
Yeah, that's a power couple, you know, for real. And also, you got to think about, as, you know, Congress gets ready to legislate on AI, Meta also has a direct connection to a U.S. senator who has influence on Capitol Hill. So that's a...
None of which is to say she's not qualified for this job.
No.
Of course, it just means that...
Her resume is strong. Yeah.
Her resume is strong and these relationships matter. Story number two. Yep. An investigation from NJ.com raises a troubling question. Did aging fire equipment cause a Camden man's death? In the early morning hours of November 12th, the fire broke out in the room of 60-year-old Eric Way. Way was recovering from hip surgery, had no way to exit the room. His nephew called the fire department. However, the closest fire crew was waylaid because one of its trucks had an air pump leak and its primary truck was already out for service. Another company arrived 2 minutes after the first crew would have arrived. By then, Eric Way was severely burned and he died from his injuries the next day. Now, a spokesperson for the Camden Fire Department told NJ.com there was no proof that this truck delay caused Way's death. However, the outlet's investigation revealed there are recurring issues with Camden's aging fleet of fire trucks, and this is a broader problem in the Garden State. The cost for new trucks has soared in recent years. There have been long production delays, and as a result, many departments are working with aging equipment.
Yeah, this is, first of all, my condolences to that family. I can only imagine their pain, wishing that their loved one didn't have to die such a painful death, yeah, because this was brutal. And I think this story sort of underscores that every minute counts in emergency situations. And it doesn't sound like anyone is necessarily blaming the fire department here, but it does raise a lot of questions. If this truck worked properly, would they have gotten there in time, right? Would his life have been saved? Could better equipment, working equipment, save lives? I mean, and you know, you think about Camden, it's a lower income community. They do have a lot of issues there. And this is not just something, you know, unique to them. It's happening all over the state. But we have to focus on some of this infrastructure, some of this equipment, and make sure that we can save lives. I mean, and hopefully this story will, you know, sort of sound the alarm to politicians and those with purse strings.
Yep. And hats off to NJ.com for the investigation. Yeah. Story number three, Cherry.
Yeah, since we're talking about investments, Wawa is closing its futuristic location in University City. And all of this comes just as Sheetz makes its move in Wawa territory.
Let me break tell it all you about down. This. Break yeah. it all down.
This location I'm referring to is on Drexel's campus at 33rd and Market Street. The store opened back in 2018 and had to deal with all kinds of panhandling and theft. So in 2023, they closed briefly and transitioned to a shelfless, all digital store where customers could just shop and order food virtually using their app and in-store kiosks. The staff there would just leave it at a customer pickup window.
Wait, and so there was nothing on the shelves?
Nothing on the shelves.
Empty Wawa.
Empty Wawa. You walk in there, you use the app. Boom, staff would leave everything for customers, okay? So you didn't have to pick anything. And they thought, hey, customers are going to love this. It'll be more efficient. They'll love it. Well, the idea turned out to be a flop. And now Wawa is closing that location, citing business decisions.
One might say, wah, wah, wah.
And, you know, Wawa's closed about a dozen locations in the city. They cited reduced foot traffic. They also had some crime issues. But this is all coming as Sheetz has moved into the region. Sheetz, Wawa's arch nemesis, is opening its first ever location in Montgomery County in Limerick. Wawa, Sheetz is coming for you, man.
The ultimate troll will be to take over this particular location in West Philadelphia.
Ooh, yeah, because who knows what they're going to do with that space?
Yeah. I think, obviously Sheetz is not running its business for the lulz, but the funniest thing to do at this point would be to open a Sheetz in Center City, Philadelphia.
You're going to turn the Wawa people, they're going to come for you.
I don't care.
You're not scared of the Wawa people.
But do you have a go-to Wawa order, by the way?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
I do.
What is it?
Well, first of all, I get the same coffee when I go to Wawa.
Yeah.
Which is 100% Colombian, a little.
100%.
100% Colombian. but I love like their chicken salad wrap with bacon. Chicken salad okay. club wrap. How so about you?
Well, this is an issue for me, actually. Thanks for asking. So when I first started going to Wawa, I was an Italian hoagie guy.
Oh, okay.
Then I became, you know, for health reasons, I suppose, a turkey hoagie guy. Then I kind of stopped eating meat regularly. And as a non-meat eater, Wawa doesn't offer you a whole lot more above just going to your corner
Do
store
better.
And like picking up a bag of chips. They got the salads, eh. You
they know got what the I mean? Good apple slices, though. But they're like expensive considering you could just get
I
one
could just
apple
get an
cheaper.
Apple
yeah.
And eat it with my teeth.
Mm-hmm. That's Anyways. Facts.
Back, can we just go back to the futuristic Wawa, the sort of no shelves Wawa for a second?
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that it failed means, presumably, that the theft issues at the store were not the core problem.
No.
Because their model got rid of the theft issues. There was nothing to steal.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it still didn't quite work. So either the trade-off wasn't worth it, or the theft issues were not particularly like causing
and
the
that's
issue.
A weird location right where it is. I've driven by that location. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, so
at the end of the day, old school Wawa for the win, right?
Yeah, I go to my Wawa a couple times a week. You know, I get gas and then I go in there and say maybe it's time for a chicken salad club.
Aramingo.
Yeah, Aramingo. Yeah,
I know that one. I know that
that's
one.
That's a busy Wawa, man.
That's a popping Wawa.
That Wawa's popping.
Man, you can staff that with robots, people, whatever. It's going to be popping on
no
Aramingo
matter what.
Avenue.
Yeah.
All right. So the main topic today is not Wawa whatsoever.
No, it's a
We're
serious
talking
topic,
about
yeah.
a pair of cases before the Supreme Court at this very moment that have to do with whether or not states can bar transgender athletes from competing in women's and girls' sports. We want your thoughts on this. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org, and don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing arguments today about one of the most divisive issues in recent years. Can states bar transgender student athletes from playing on women's and girls' sports teams? This question has been a cultural flashpoint for many and a thorny one for K-12 schools and universities and colleges who are trying to figure it out.
There are 24 states that have passed laws restricting transgender girls and women from participating in sports. The two cases before the court today, one from West Virginia and one from Idaho, touch on some big constitutional questions, including Title IX, which prevents sex discrimination in education, and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Fundamentally, it comes down to issues of fairness, competition, equal protection, and inclusion. Oral arguments began this morning with the Idaho case and the issue of whether or not transgender people should get extra constitutional protections came up very early on in the oral arguments. Here's Alan Hirsch, the Idaho Solicitor General, defending the state law, responding to a question from Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch.
What we're really looking for is classes that look like race or like sex. And if you compare the discrimination in this case, where not one of the laws they cite actually classifies expressly on the basis of transgender status. If we look at that history and we compare it to the history of African Americans and women who were not able to vote, who were not able to own property, who had express classifications based on their status written into the law for most of this country's history, these things don't compare.
So today we're going to walk through the big arguments before the justices with a pair of legal scholars and talk about what's at stake with this decision. With us in studio, we have Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova University. Michael, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
And our question for you today, as we get our other guest ready via Zoom, hold tight for that. Our question for you is this: should transgender athletes be allowed to compete in women's and girls' sports? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. If you're on YouTube or Facebook, do us a favor and drop your comments in the chat.
And so, Michael, we're going to have you kind of set us up because there's these two cases. Before we get into the facts, though, the issue of transgender rights have been bubbling up in the surface over the past few years. But I really want to just sort of get an understanding of what's at stake when the U.S. Supreme Court makes this decision in these cases.
Well, in these cases, as you say, they're grappling with the constitutional and statutory questions under the civil rights laws about whether or not the decisions of 27 states now to prohibit transgender athletes from competing in women's and girls' sports, whether those policy choices of the states are contrary to the U.S. Constitution and Title IX of the civil rights laws. And so that's the issue. But there have been recent cases as well touching on some of these same transgender questions, a case last year involving a Tennessee law that prohibited gender transitioning medical treatments for minors. The Supreme Court upheld that. And then a case from farther back involving whether or not Title VII, the employment discrimination law, prohibits discrimination based on transgender status. So a lot of issues around this, but today's question that they're still hearing oral argument on is this question of transgender athletes.
Yeah.
Now let's bring in our other guest. This is Kate Shaw, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and a host of the legal podcast Strict Scrutiny. First, before I ask you any questions, Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're talking about the stakes here. Mm-hmm. So Michael kind of laid the groundwork there. Mm-hmm. But there's sort of the if then what of these two cases before the courts today. So if the states win, what does that mean in the broader scope of trans rights?
Well, it would be a setback to trans rights claims, absolutely, if the states win and are told that they can exclude trans girls and women from playing girls and women's sports. So, you know, there are two cases. One involved a student, or one involves a student who wanted to play at the college athletic level, and actually the other a middle schooler. And I thought that the arguments are still ongoing, so we actually really only heard one of the cases argued. But the lawyer for the student in that first case, Kathleen Hartnett, I thought really did a powerful job of underscoring that all that her client was asking for was the opportunity to play for a trans girl who has essentially taken the steps to mitigate any potentially unfair advantages that having been born male would confer athletically. So this is a kid who's going to compete essentially like other girls and women on the sports teams. So this is not asking to disable sex segregated sports, or really even a broad rule that says anybody who essentially identifies as transgender gets to play. It's actually a very narrow ask that is being made, but obviously a win for the states would be a setback to would-be student athletes situated like the plaintiffs in these cases.
And so let's go a little bit into the facts of each of the cases, because the Supreme Court made the decision to sort of couple these cases under one umbrella, but they do represent different issues. And so let's start with the case out of Idaho first. Could you just lay out the facts for me, Kate, and then we'll have you do the facts for the West Virginia case, Michael?
Sure thing, right. So the Idaho case is the one that involves the college level athlete. This is a student who wanted to play in Idaho and encountered the obstacle of this 2020 law passed in Idaho that basically bans trans girls and women from participating in all sports functionally. Like, you know, as a technical matter, trans girls and women are not barred from playing on boys and men's teams, but it's essentially a non-starter to offer that as an alternative to individuals living and identifying as girls and women. Really, girls and women's athletics are the only viable option for them. And this law passed in 2020, one of the first of a slew of laws like this, essentially bars that participation. So the student, Lindsay Hecox, wanted to play, you know, or run, I guess, athletic track and field, and ultimately failed to qualify for the college team. And so her case has an interesting wrinkle, which is that she's actually trying to drop the case altogether. Essentially, she didn't make the team that she wanted to make. And so she played at the club level, which she actually was allowed to do, and has asked the lower courts in this case to dismiss the case as essentially moot. There's no longer a live dispute. She says, even if she wins this case, she's going to graduate within the next year, and she no longer wishes to pursue an athletic career, even at the collegiate level anyway, in part because of the negative publicity and stress that involvement in this litigation has created for her in her life. And so she's asking for the case to be dismissed. But those essentially are the underlying facts that gave rise to the dispute that was the first argument the court heard this morning.
Yeah. And the West Virginia case, Michael, could you tell us the facts of that?
Right. Similar statutory provision enacted at the state level. As Kate mentioned, this was actually a student. We only have her initials because she's a minor. But starting in middle school, sought to participate in girl sports, and that was against the provisions of this West Virginia law. So that's the plaintiff in the West Virginia case. And really, I think that except for this mootness issue, which Kate mentioned involving the Idaho plaintiff, the cases really are pretty similar. There's actually one of them has the Title IX aspect, and the other is only an equal protection case. But those are kind of technical in the weeds points. I think given that we, as I mentioned, we have 27 states that have enacted these kinds of laws, that basically, this case, this issue is going to have to be resolved one way or the other, no matter, who the plaintiff was or what the posture of the case might have been.
Now, Michael, some people listening might say, and they're not looking at this through a legal lens, they would be able to say these cases are vastly different. Here you have one plaintiff who transitioned much earlier in their life, is trying to compete at a much lower level of sports. It's in the K-12 spectrum. It's not in the college level. Do you think the law cares about that at all? And in some ways, the question is, does the biological debate, the scientific debate around fairness matter at all when you are considering how to apply Title IX or the 14th Amendment of the Constitution? Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the state's argument in these cases is that they're not discriminating based on transgender status at all. It applies to biological males across the board, biological males who are still are not transgender, and biological males who are transgender and become transgender women or girls. It applies to them all equally, and so there's no classification based on transgender status at all, at any level, K through 12 or at the college level. It is true, and this came up a little bit at oral argument, I'm not sure it'll be a big factor in the case at all, that, you know, the competitive advantage for biological males is less pronounced earlier on, before puberty. So there's some, you know, some scientific issues that are kind of circling around the case.
Do you think that matters, though, in a legal debate? That, put aside whether that sways public opinion, I'm curious, can that factor into how a jurist looks at this?
It could factor in, I would say, to my mind, it factors in less at the level of constitutional review, more at the level of policy choices that states might make. So some states might have provisions that say that that these kinds of prohibitions on transgender athletes competing in women's girls sports only apply, say, after, you know, a certain grade level or something like that. Those are policy trade-offs that state legislatures are equipped to make and empowered to make. The issue here in the Supreme Court cases today, though, is about the constitutional question and whether states have the ability to make those kinds of policy determinations in the first place.
By the way, I want to bring in a caller. Kathy from King of Prussia is on the line. Kathy, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. My question is, if a child is born with brain chemistry that says they are one gender, but physical manifestation that says they are another gender, isn't that like a birth defect? That's a medical issue. And if it's a medical issue that has to be addressed, why are not trans people covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act?
Interesting question.
Okay, so Kate, I'll put that to you. So what's at issue, what's at stake here seems to be interpretations of Title IX and the 14th Amendment. Why, first of all, why are those the two sort of battlegrounds here? And why wouldn't something like the Americans for Disabilities Act be potentially part of the debate as well?
You know, the ADA question, let me put it to the side for 1 second. And just, you know, in terms of the constitutional and Title IX statutory questions in the case, you know, those are the way the cases were litigated. Both contain this constitutional question. The second case involving the middle school student, BPJ, also has, as Michael was saying, the statutory Title IX argument in the case. And unfortunately, we started recording before they really had gotten deep into the Title IX part of the argument. So I'm not totally sure what it seems the justices are making of that argument. But I do think that, you know, this question of how the law should treat transgender status. I mean, there is something, I don't think this was the spirit of the question, but one would obviously want to be careful about anything that would appear to, or I would want to be careful anyway, but anything that would appear to really kind of pathologize the state of being transgender, and in a way that I would worry that classification as a disability might kind of create that impression. Obviously, there are legal requirements for accommodation that the Americans with Disabilities Act imposes. But I'm not sure, at least in kind of current understandings of gender dysphoria and kind of treatments for transgender status, those would align with sort of the definition of disability under the Americans with Disabilities Act. But in terms of kind of what sort of how transgender status is treated under the law, there is this interesting constitutional question of whether laws that single out transgender individuals draw heightened constitutional scrutiny, meaning courts take a closer look at a law that distinguishes on the basis of being transgender than they would a law that draws any number of other classifications that laws draw all the time, right? On the basis of something like age, laws draw distinctions about when you can get a driver's license. That's not a distinction that the law says courts are going to look at very closely, but some kinds of classifications on the basis of things like race and sex do draw heightened scrutiny, and the court has never said whether gender identity is like race and sex in drawing that scrutiny.
And that's sort of the question that I have. And we played a clip in the setup to this that dealt with that issue. I wonder if there's any sort of light or a roadmap in the law that you've seen that sort of helps us all determine how a group can go from just being a group outside of a protected class to moving into one. I think that, you know, you have the plaintiffs trying to make this argument that maybe transgender individuals as a group should be some type of either quasi protected or fully protected class so that they can get higher scrutiny under the law. Michael, you know, what are your thoughts about that? How do you move from just being a regular group to one that requires higher scrutiny?
Well, I think that's a much higher mountain to climb than probably Kate does in terms of a group becoming one to which there is a protected class under 14th Amendment analysis. Because what the court has looked to is a history of legal discrimination, a long history, and again, using race as the paradigm instance of a long and ugly history of discrimination in the law. And the classifications in which the law was drawing lines based on race that had this odious component. And that, as in the case last year, the Tennessee case involving prohibition on minor gender transitioning treatments, there were concurrences both by Justice Barrett and by Justice Alito saying that even though that case didn't get to the question of whether or not transgender status should be a protected class under the 14th Amendment, but they said, but it should not be, and applies the analysis that the court has worked on for many decades to determine whether or not you can move, as the question suggests, from being a group that is outside the protection of the 14th Amendment equal protection guarantee to one that's within it.
Yeah. It brings up this larger question for me, Kate, of what do we mean when we say a history of discrimination?
Yeah.
Is it 50 years? Is it 70 years? Is it 300 years? And then how do you establish that as a matter of law? Because, of course, people interpret history differently. What's your take on that question, Kate? What is it, a length of time? Is it a severity of targeting? What matters to you when you read the Constitution and you try to consider what group should be considered a protected class?
Yeah, I think Michael is right. We probably disagree normatively in terms of how easy we think it should be to establish that a group is protected. But I think I probably share the kind of descriptive assessment that the court is, you know, it is an uphill battle to convince this court to announce protected status for any new group, but I think in particular transgender individuals. I should say the majority in the case last term out of Tennessee, Scrimeti, actually didn't resolve the question one way or another, but Justice Barrett in her concurring opinion did say, I would find that gender identity is not a suspect class, does not warrant heightened constitutional scrutiny. And you know, it came up a little bit this morning in the oral argument, and the lawyer for the plaintiffs mentioned things like official discrimination against transgender individuals in categorical immigration exclusions for individuals who are transgender, in state and local laws that criminalized cross-dressing, leaving the house wearing the clothes that did not match the, you know, sex you were born. And so that is, you know, those are criminal penalties and categorical prohibitions in the law. So that is a pretty serious history of discrimination. I think the list is much longer than that, but those were the two examples that came up today.
And how much do you balance history versus what's happening now? Because I think many trans people would point to, say, the
recent years.
The prohibitions on self-identification on your passport. That's fairly recent, right, Kate? Mm-hmm. But I mean, they would say that, I would imagine they would say that that counts. That counts quite a lot for us, even though it is not something you would find in a dusty old history book. But what does the law say about that?
The law doesn't say much because honestly, we haven't had a lot of kind of, the trajectory has mostly been less official discrimination against discrete groups. And I think quite honestly, within the last year and 5 to maybe 7 years, but especially in the last year, we have had a real uptick in official discrimination against transgender individuals. So I think it's right. The test, it really does look to history and maybe doesn't sufficiently account for recent developments. But I think that it would be a mistake to overlook things because they are recent, because I think we have had a spate of very serious types of official discrimination, in particular from the current federal government against transgender individuals as a group.
Yeah. By the way, I want to invite you, our listeners, to participate in the conversation. Should transgender athletes be allowed to compete in women's and girls' sports? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, leave a comment in the chat. I want to bring in a caller. We have Charlotte from Philly on the line. Charlotte, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I'm a transgender woman and I work in medicine. Big sports fan. I appreciate that you all are having this conversation today. I do have, my main concern that I wanted to bring up is that I think a lot of people that are leading this conversation are folks that are not involved in medicine, sports, science, are not trans, and it's creating a lot of like this confusion about what's going on. Trans medicine is actually more than a century old. And the question of trans athletes goes back even to the 70s, I think. Radiolab from WNYC did a great series called Gonads that delves into this topic. I really recommend it. But, you know, I my concern is just that I think that this conversation isn't being led by people who actually are informed on the topic, and instead it's a very reactionary response that's fueled by, frankly, misogyny, not even just transphobia, but this inherent belief that men are physically superior and superior in every way to women.
Yeah, thank you so much. So go ahead, Charlotte. You have one more thing to add there?
No, I just that was my thoughts. So I appreciate you all very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte.
Thank you so much, Charlotte, for that comment.
And because Charlotte asked about medicine, biology, I think we actually have a medical provider on the line as well. This is Mike from Bethlehem. Mike, I hope I have that right, that you are a medical provider, and I'm curious for your thoughts. You're on Studio 2, Mike.
Yeah, thank you for taking the call. Dr. Pipestone, I'm a family medicine doctor. I provide gender-affirming care in my area. And I agree 100% with the previous caller that people are not really informed on this topic who are making decisions. Part of what I wanted to see if anyone could comment on the discussion is the dangerous precedent of biological determinism that is kind of flowing into these discussions that has been a common thread in previous areas where medicine has really failed our people. If you look at racism in medicine in the past, particularly around the 1920s and eugenics, I think it's really pretty appalling to say that people's biology is all that they can become and that we can reduce people to who they are on a cellular level. It really takes a lot away from personal liberty and personal freedoms. It also really just kind of jars me that I can write testosterone for a man, and that's appropriate gender-affirming care, but I couldn't, in some situations, in some states, write that same drug for another person who identifies as female. Yeah. Appreciate you giving me the time.
Thanks, Mike. That's Mike from Bethlehem. And so I want to get both of your reactions to this idea, because a lot of what we're talking about here is this idea of fairness. And that's been the argument on behalf of states sort of banning transgender athletes from participating in women's and girls' sports. Just your thoughts about this and the medical side of it that we've heard from both Mike and Charlotte. Is there a way to sort of level the playing field and really make it fair? And how much of that evidence is sort of included in what the judges will consider in making their decisions, Mike and Kate?
Well, I think, I think a couple things can be true at the same time. One, that transgenderism is a complex scientific, medical, the sociology of sports, that's very complicated. And there are a lot of policy judgments and decisions that have to be made by school districts and state legislatures and so forth. And second, though, that the 14th Amendment or Title IX really don't have anything to do with that. And that to constitutionalize this question and to say that the laws of 27 states on this issue are just swept away, I think would be an aggressive move by the court. I think it's very unlikely to happen, I think for good, sound constitutional legal reasons. But that doesn't mean that the caller's concerns and questions about, you know, what kind of expertise is being consulted, what kinds of decisions are being made by different states. Pennsylvania and New Jersey don't have these kinds of laws. I don't know to what extent, you know, they're being pushed or not. But, you know, these are policy judgments that, again, the state legislatures and school districts can take expert.
It's a question of whether federal law supersedes those judgments made at the state level.
Yeah.
And you're of course, saying that it doesn't. Yeah.
Yeah. And Kate, I want to get your thoughts on this as well, because it sounds like what you're saying, Michael, is that, look, yes, the states can consider medical evidence. They can consider all of this. But this is not the question here. The question here is, does the law allow them to do that? Kate. Is that what you're saying?
And they do. And look, I mean, there is a competitive, I think most people acknowledge in this debate that there is a competitive advantage, certainly pronounced post-puberty, for biological males. Now, there's a question that comes up. It was in the oral argument this morning about, well, if you stop the circulation of testosterone, that levels the playing field. But I do think that, you know, the biological reality of that is what these states are concerned about, and allowing those biological males, transgender girls, to compete against biological girls.
Yeah.
Okay, so, Kate, your thoughts real quick, I suppose, on, I guess in some ways the questions, the conflict here between the callers and with the conversation we're having is that they're looking at whether or not, on some level, these laws should be passed. And the question is whether you sort of, the biological scientific debate over these laws is really at issue at all today at the Supreme Court. Do you think it is? You think it isn't? Your thoughts?
You know, look, I think this is not a purely policy debate. I do think that it's right that legislatures can make different policy judgments, including in areas of medical uncertainty. But the Constitution is supreme law. And if the Constitution takes certain policy options off the table, then the court cannot allow states to pursue those policy options. So I think that it can be both a policy and a constitutional debate. And just on the issue of, you know, fairness, and I guess this connects to the record, mm-hmm. you know, I think that these cases, in particular, the first one out of Idaho, was litigated on a very spare record. And there is a degree of medical uncertainty about what real advantages these athletes might have. And the request being made today was that the court send this case back down or wait for a case where there's a more developed factual record. And then maybe just one thought on fairness, I'll say, I do think that, you know, look, athletics involves a lot of people with gifts that are not evenly distributed, height, strength, speed, up, so people can jump higher than others. And I am not quite sure why this is an area in which there this kind of a small number of athletes have caused this enormous, to my mind, like very unjustified hysteria on the part of legislators and the public at large. I don't think there's any very different fairness challenge that a few trans athletes pose than other kinds of athletes who might have other kinds of advantages on team.
Thank you for that, Kate. That's Kate Shaw, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania. We've also been talking with Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova. On the other side of this break, I want to consider the flip here, which is whether or not states that allow transgender girls and women to compete in girls and women's sports would be somehow vulnerable in the future, depending on how this particular case goes. We'll get to that on the other side of this break. You're listening to Studio 2. And welcome back, friends, to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are discussing the oral arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court this morning about transgender athletes and whether or not states can bar them from sports. With us are our two legal experts. We have Kate Shaw, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, and Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova University.
I want to remind you, at home, on the road, and elsewhere, we're asking you the following question today. Should transgender athletes be allowed to compete in women's and girls' sports? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. YouTube, Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. Several people asking the same question, mm-hmm. so I just want to address it. Jim from Delaware, and I believe Helen asking about sort of the reverse scenario, right, where someone who is born a biological female transitions to a man and then wants to compete on a men's team. As far as I know, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. that's not a legal question because I don't know of anywhere where that's actually not allowed. And so it'll be hard to have a aggrieved party and consider, I don't know of any restriction on that. Am I right there?
In fact, I think the Idaho Solicitor General said an oral argument. I could be misremembering this, but I think he said the boys' teams are always open. So basically, that's not an issue.
Yeah. And I also about this other reverse scenario, mm-hmm. where I teed this up on the other side of the break, Kate. So, like, I'm trying to imagine if indeed Supreme Court upholds the bans, then you look at the group of states that allow transgender women and girls to compete on women's and girls teams. Could there be a constitutional argument that that is illegal because it somehow disadvantages women who do have certain protections under the law, or it's some sort of sex discrimination against the women who are the biological women who were born female at birth who compete on those teams? I mean, does it open that up at all, or is that just totally off the table, has nothing to do with this?
I wouldn't say it's off the table. It is not, to my mind, a remotely winning argument, but it is one that Justice Kavanaugh seemed to be at least sort of floating, not endorsing, but just asking about the potential, you know, down the road consequences of the states prevailing here. What does that mean about the states, about half of them that do allow trans athletes to compete on girls and women's teams? I think that to embrace that kind of argument would be to essentially accept a very, even more than is offered in these cases, kind of protectionist logic about the need for protection of girls and women on teams that has not justified government action, that kind of explicit protectionism, really since the 1970s, when the court basically started saying that, well, stereotypes, including stereotypes about the need to protect women, are not a basis on which government can act. And in some ways, that argument reminds me of the logic of a case from 1908, Mueller versus Oregon, that basically allowed for separate kind of working conditions laws for laundresses who are girls and women in order to protect their kind of fragile conditions and childbearing. So it would, I think, to my mind, be reviving very discredited logic to accept an argument like that. But I imagine if the states win here, we will see those arguments being made quickly.
Do you agree, Michael, that it's a long shot? And do you agree that this could be coming?
I think, in fact, I think there's a footnote in the Solicitor General's brief where they kind of set aside this question. They say, you know, they kind of suggest it might be that Title IX, in the interest of protecting the competitive integrity and fairness for women's and girls' sports, has some legal effect on the states that allow biological men, transgender women to participate in them. But again, that it did come up a couple times in the parts of the argument I heard today, and the side seemed to say that's a question for another day. But there is a kind of suggestion out there that
that implies there's another day,
issue,
though.
Right.
That implies there's another day.
By the way, I want to remind you, our listeners at home, on the road, and elsewhere, to participate in the conversation. Our question is, should transgender athletes be allowed to compete in women's and girls' sports? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, drop a comment in the chat. I have another line of questioning, but before we go there, I want to bring in Matthew from Wynwood, who's on the line. Matt, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to call in and just highlight one thing. I have a family member who's transgender. She was born with her gonads did not normally develop in the womb. And so she can't have children. She's an adult now. She can't have children. And she's had hormonal therapy throughout her entire life. Now, she's never tried to play sports. And that particular aspect isn't relevant here. But it's not a choice all the time. I mean, folks are born without fully developed, you know, parts. And they end up being called transgender, but it's not a choice. It's something that they have to have treatment for throughout their lives. And so the idea that, like, these people don't exist under the Constitution, as far as SCOTUS is concerned, I mean, that's ridiculous. That's refusing to acknowledge reality of science. I'll take, you know, I can listen off air. I don't want to go on. But I would thank you for the conversation today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Matthew from Wynwood. Also, Carol asked that question. What about people who are born intersex? That is, someone born looking female but are XY chromosomes, so they are genetically male and have internal male organs. Does this case at all, Kate, deal with this topic in the least?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, I do think an intersex kind of can present in lots of different ways. I should say the Tennessee law, the one that barred certain kinds of gender affirming care for children, had an explicit exception for intersex, you know, gender affirming care of whatever sort for intersex children. I don't think either the Idaho or the West Virginia law here explicitly deals with intersex status, but I do think that incidentally, it might end up excluding intersex individuals who are actually a significant segment of the population from participation in sports because of this very kind of binary, biologically determined definition of sex that exists in the laws in both states.
Yeah, so we need to be more thoughtful. I do want to ask the question about the court, because this is a very conservative court. There had been this light in the Scrimeti case with an expansion in a lot of ways of, you know, transgender rights. They got protection in the workplace. You cannot fire somebody because they are trans. But the court has sort of leaned in the other cases we've seen, the Bostock case sort of closing ranks. I want to know what you'll be looking for in the justices, what you'll be paying attention to when you have a chance to analyze who asked what questions, when you're trying to figure out how these cases will go, Michael.
You're right. I mean, Bostock, the Title VII case, which is the employment discrimination case, is kind of looming out there. And there is a question about assuming that Idaho and West Virginia will win, which I think is the likely outcome here, how will the court go about differentiating the decision in Bostock? And I think the view there would be that employment discrimination there are different factors at work in that context. Even the statutory language is different. And so I think but interesting to see kind of how that goes. And then just generally, I think the questions that came up in the parts that I heard earlier today about there's some technical issues about as applied challenges and like how big does a class have to be before they kind of, you know, fall within the domain of equal protection. So there's some kind of technical legal issues about that. But you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, the Scrimeti case last year, although it sidestepped the question of transgender discrimination, said it's just classification based on medical treatment. There's really no classification based on transgender. I think you saw that in Scrimeti, you saw that, as I said earlier, in some of the concurrences especially, I think you saw the sort of tell the the court telegraphing the outcome in a case like the one we have today.
Yeah, and Kate, just your thoughts. Like, what will you be looking for? Because, you know, we have a very conservative court. What will you be looking for to determine whether the states are going to prevail in these cases or whether trans rights will be expanded or protected here?
It is a conservative court, and yet there is that Bostock decision from 2020 that does confer employment protections. And Justice Gorsuch, who is one of the more conservative members of the court, is the author of that opinion. The Chief Justice, John Roberts, actually joined that opinion, again, siding with the rights against employment discrimination of gay and trans employees. And so I think that Roberts and Gorsuch were sort of the two to watch today. And Gorsuch actually sent some signals that he might be more sympathetic to the plaintiff's claims than I, you know, than one might have assumed, because he did join the majority rejecting the minors' arguments in the Scrimeti case involving medical care out of Tennessee. Roberts was a little harder to read, but I think it's at least, I would say that those are the two to watch, and they at least sent something like mixed signals today. Although I agree with Michael's bottom line conclusion, the states are more likely to prevail here. I do not think that is 100% a certain conclusion, at least coming out of what I heard from the arguments this morning.
And of course, Gorsuch's opinion was cited, I think, liberally by the plaintiffs in these cases. No surprise.
Yeah.
Let's bring in a caller now. This is Lena from New Jersey on line three. We're a little short on time, Lena, so if you could keep it brief, you're on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for taking my call. My concern is that in the rarity instance of transgender youth being involved in sports, it's a rare circumstance. And if our concern is truly women's health and women's safety, because I don't hear the conversation so much on the other end of transgender males on teams, my concern is, you know, how are they going to check? How are you going to prevent from sexual assault or inappropriate contact with these female athletes if, let's say, there's a witch hunt going on in this town and someone says, you know what, that girl doesn't look female enough, I think she may be transgender? I mean, have the courts at all considered all the safety issues in place for women just for the accusations of being transgender? I mean, Larry Nassar trials were not that far away.
Thank you, Lena.
Thank
so
you.
Lena's asking
comments off the air.
Yeah, Lena's asking about enforcement mechanisms here and whether or not the Supreme Court can consider that when trying to weigh the constitutionality of these laws. Michael and Kate, your thoughts briefly on that.
Well, again, I'll go back. It just underscores to me the policy judgments that are being made here. How you check, it came up a little bit today, like, you know, blood tests for circulating testosterone and other kinds, you know, all kinds of issues about how do you figure out who falls on what side of the line or the other. It just underscores to me that these are policy judgments that school districts and legislatures should be able to make, and that the 14th Amendment doesn't speak to it.
Kate, real quick, I mean, there are blood tests, right? It's not necessary. I think what the caller's envisioning, like a visual check.
Actually,
of some
the,
sort.
The
I don't know if that's
right.
What's, yeah, go ahead.
No, the Idaho law says that if there is a dispute which can be raised by an opposing team or a team member or even a bystander, okay, the act says the dispute has to be resolved by looking to the student's reproductive anatomy, genetic makeup, or normal testosterone levels. This could be really invasive. And in terms of thinking about what justifies a law like this, I don't think it's inappropriate for the court to consider the kinds of checking mechanisms the law might create.
Wow, so interesting. But we only have a couple minutes left, so I want to zoom out because there are other cases currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. I want to ask each of you, besides this transgender rights issue with trans athletes, are there other cases you're paying attention to? If you could take about 45 seconds, Michael, leave 45.
Mostly involving the administration and the scope of presidential power. The case that was recently argued about the president's ability to remove federal officers, and then I'd say maybe the biggest case of the term, although it's hard to pick, was the birthright citizenship issue, which has been granted and will probably be argued, I'm guessing, probably in April.
And you're predicting that the court will actually deal with the question versus last time when they did not?
Because the question they've granted cert on, it raises the question.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And Kate, the big cases you're paying attention to.
I agree with those. I would throw in the Fed chair or the Fed member removal case that's going to be argued next week, in addition to the removal case involving the Federal Trade Commission the court already heard argued. And then I would include the case about really the future of the Voting Rights Act. That could be decided very soon. The court is issuing decisions tomorrow, so that's at least in theory possible. And then the president's tariff authority, and then likely other cases involving presidential power the court has either already agreed to hear or will very likely agree to hear in the near term. And then the shadow docket looming over all of this largely. The court decides a lot of emergency motions, cases we haven't even heard about yet, but that will be very consequential.
Well, I want to thank both of you for some great insights today.
Yeah.
Kate Shaw, professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and host of the podcast Strict Scrutiny. Kate, thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Michael Moreland, professor of law and religion at Villanova University. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be with you.
And I just have to read this comment Josh wrote on Facebook. I wonder if there has been any consideration into a trans and non-binary gender category. Seems this would open space for people to be themselves and compete without having to deal with binary gender politics. That's a comment from Josh on Facebook. Got to say thank you to everybody who called in today. We had some great callers who provided much needed insight. And of course, I got to thank our producers, Debbie Bilder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's general manager. We usually shout her out on Thursdays, but we're doing it today.
Hey, come on, Joan.
We could do it every day.
We could do it any day.
Every day. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm just going to shout out Joan Isabella again. Why not?
Yeah, Joan
double down.
Bam.
And I have to, by the way, Donna from Lansdale was on the line for a long time. We just did not have enough time to get to Donna. But we appreciate the call, Donna. I'll also say my own name, I suppose. I'm Avi Wolfman. Thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you tomorrow.